Subway everyday value means many mouth-watering pile-high favorites are $5 footlongs, like the fresh-toasted tempting meatball marinara and made-to-your-order BLT. The $5 footlong anthem rolls on only at Subway, where great everyday value lives. Subway, eat fresh.
The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. He must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
Welcome to the BS Report. We like to have celebrities on from time to time. And this guy certainly qualifies. He's on the Subway Fresh Take hotline right now. David Duchovny, what's happening?
Hey, how are you? It's my honor and privilege to be here.
Well, we had never exchanged emails until about, I think, like 6 weeks ago. And I had a mailbag.
Right.
I had a mailbag where I had the Diane Lane All-Stars for my over 40 hot-looking woman. We have a mutual friend, and I get an email out of nowhere from you. You were outraged that it didn't include your wife on the list. And I didn't realize that she was 40, and that's why she didn't make it. So we hashed it out.
I told her that, and that was the best way out of it you could have ever imagined. And I also told her that you were thinking of starting a new team of those who are 40 and don't look at hot all-stars, and that she was going to hit leadoff, maybe?
Maybe. If I named it after her, I think I would win even more points.
That
was the ultimate compliment, though, that I had no idea she was 40.
It is, and she can hit anywhere in your lineup.
Yeah. I'm going to blow it out. I might have like a 25-man roster. I was even thinking about this. I think I need to go.
That might be tough.
I think I could get it.
The Bush Leagues for that one.
There's a lot more out there than I realize. And then you get on top of it, you have some actresses lie about their age, and then they become honest later in their career.
Much like Dominican players.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
So you got to figure that out.
Or Cuban boxers. You're promoting a movie. Let's just get this out of the way, the movie thing. Then we can hit the other
movie
stuff.
Is The Joneses. The Joneses, damn it. I wish I knew when it came out. It comes out in like 2 weeks. Maybe you can add that at the end. I'm an idiot for not knowing the exact date. But
no, I'm going to guess. It's April 14th because usually movies come out on a Friday, and that would be 10 days. We're taping this on a Monday. So there you go.
I like it. I like it. Let's just say it's April 14th. It's with Demi Moore and I, and it's a really smart, I'd call it a dark comedy.
Okay.
I don't even know what that means, but I'm going to call it that.
As opposed to a black comedy?
Yeah, that doesn't sound right to me.
All right. I've never heard dark comedy. I've heard the black comedy.
Yeah.
But maybe you're creating a new thing.
It's a strong movie, and I'm proud of it. And it's not going to be a really wide release, so people have got to get out there and see it, and then maybe it'll get a little wider.
Didn't it premiere at the Toronto Film Festival?
It did. It premiered at Toronto, and it got picked up there for distribution. And it's just a really great idea that I read a while ago. I think I read the script maybe 3 or 4 years ago, and I can give it away, even though
no, don't.
Did you say?
No, don't give the plot away.
Okay, I won't give the plot away. But it's a very smart idea that once you see it or once you read it, you go, damn, I should have thought of that because that's a great movie.
Somebody like you, you've made enough money, you've had a career, whatever. When you have these independent movies that come to you, and a lot of times, obviously, you're not going to make the money that you would normally make if you just did a normal movie.
Right.
How do you choose, it's almost like a vanity project to some degree, but then if it does well, then that's also good, and you probably get, points at the back end, all that stuff. But how do you choose, which way to play those, versus, big movie versus, the small, cute movie?
Well, it is exactly as you described. It's if something comes your way that you think is a part that you really want to play or a movie that you really want to be involved with or another actor who's doing it that you really want to do with, or a director who's doing it that you like. So there are many ways into a project when money is not the way into it. So, the longer I live and the more I work, the better experiences I have when I choose things for the right idea rather than the wrong one. So,
was it like dominoes though, where you want to do it, but at the same time you want to make sure somebody like Demi Moore is in it too?
It is. Everybody kind of stays at the starting line, like, exactly right. Everybody's kind of there like, well, if he does it or she does it, then I'll do it. And but nobody wants to put their foot in first. And then somebody does, and then it does roll.
So have you ever had an experience where you're like, all right, I'll put my foot in, and then nobody else put the foot in? You're like, hey, guys, I'm over here.
Yeah, usually when I write the script, that's what happens.
In the last few years, you most of the stuff you've done since X-Files has been pretty, like, not mainstream. Conscious decision?
Well, both, you know. I mean, the mainstream got smaller in a way. The kind of movies that you get to do in the mainstream got narrower, and the pool of actors that are considered bankable got narrower as everybody kind of got scared of the economics of the business. So it was a combination of having been in a show that was immensely popular and having had that and not really wanting to necessarily do that again, and wanting to try different things as an actor, writer, director, which seemed to come to me more on the smaller indie level than on the big blockbuster level.
So then you do Californication, which really pushes the envelope in a lot of different ways. That was kind of a counter strategy move to some degree.
I don't really know how that happened. I wasn't planning on doing any more television, but then the nature of cable now is that you can do a whole season in 3 months. I never wanted to be tied up for another 10 and a half month run, which is kind of what the X-Files was from year to year. So that opened up the door for me. And then the comedy and the Californication was really it was the kind of comedy that I had wanted to do that I hadn't seen coming my way, and it was a little different from the mainstream comedy, even though I think actually the Californication comedy has kind of gone mainstream now with The Hangover, movies like this. So it's almost like, I don't want to say that the movie's caught up, but I think that taste changed a little bit more towards the kind of comedy that I wanted to do, not just sexual content at all necessarily, but more like verbal and I saw Californication as being a really intelligent, comedic voice, and going back to like the farces of the 70s, like Shampoo and The Last Detail, when you could actually have adults in a comedy rather than like Gilligan.
Yeah, the first time I realized that you had a sense of humor, because, you know, let's face it, for a few years there, you were the X-Files guy, and then you did Larry Sanders. And you're showing your scrotum and all the gay crush on Larry. I think my reaction was probably like everybody else was like, wait a second, what's going on here? This guy's funny? Like, did it bother you that you had a sense of humor and yet that wasn't able to obviously be exhibited in X-Files?
Well, you know, there were some funny X-Files, we like to say, but the vast majority were not. So that's the lasting impression that's left. It's kind of dark and somber. But I found at some point, even after Sanders, that whenever I would do something that was either funny or meant to be funny, that people would always react with surprise. So in some ways, it's just I think it has to do with I'm somewhat deadpan maybe, in general or dry. So I think sometimes, it's very close to the way I play things when I'm serious. So it can be confusing a little bit, but I think forever people are going to be surprised that I'm funny because of just that first impression.
Well, I think Californication's probably fix that for
most part. I just think, you know, I think you make a good point, which is when you want to make a career change, just show your scrotum.
That's the blueprint from that one.
I think so.
It was probably one of my favorite episodes too. When did they first ask you to host Saturday Night Live?
Oh God!
Late 90s, right?
Probably like 96, 95. That was kind of a dream come true, you know, growing up when I did, to be able to host SNL was such a big, big deal. And that was fun to be asked and to be able to do it twice. And I'd love to do it again sometime.
The Larry Sanders thing, how did that develop? Was that your idea or his?
Well, I'd wanted to go on Sanders because I loved the show, and I was getting the tapes sent up to me in Vancouver when I was doing X-Files, and I didn't know Gary, and I just said to my agents, please, if there's any way that I can be one of their celebrity guests on the show, that's my favorite show, I want to be on it. So they got me this part the first time, which was to play myself and to get bumped off of the show and to get pissed off and really kind of make an ass of myself for being bumped by, I can't remember who went long.
Yeah.
And so we did that, but I met Gary, and he invited me to his basketball game through that, and we became friends. And I like to tell this story because Gary, I was sitting in the audience watching Gary work, and he walked by me, and I introduced myself. He had no clue who I was, and we were just about to do a scene like a half an hour later. And
he had no idea who you were?
No clue. No clue. Wow. He looked at me like you look at a stalker. And we went down and we get the scene that we're going to do, because it wasn't improvised, but it was loose. It was really a loose way to work, really wonderful way to work. And we did one take, and Gary kind of did a double take to me, and he looked at me and he goes, how old are you? And I said, whatever I was at the time, 34 or something, 35. And he goes, what took you so long?
Wow.
You know, so that was always our, you know, that's like the benchmark for me. It was like, you know, Gary, you know, at that point anointed me. You know, I was like, oh, okay, I got something.
And then you guys actually became legitimately friends.
Really good friends. And when I lived in L.A., we would he has a basketball game at his house every Sunday, and I'd play most every Sunday.
Be honest, no sugarcoating. Like, what's the quality of play at the basketball game? It's really hard for me to believe that this is like semi-pro level caliber games.
Depends who shows up. Depends how many women show up. It depends who shows up.
Well, there's your first problem. Depends on how many women show up. That's a red flag coming out of the gate.
That's a joke. The only woman that ever showed up was Sarah Silverman.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you're saying...
Is she good? No, not necessarily.
No, it's a drawback to be a woman on a basketball court. They don't have the right ACL
and PCLs. About Griner? Griner's going to kill me.
That's true.
Griner will stuff me and then stuff on me. So
who is the best celebrity player in those games?
Who's good? You know, Sandler's got an interesting game.
Really?
He's kind of tough. He's strong. He's a lot stronger than you think. He's kind of a guy that you don't like playing against because he puts his ass on you.
Physical.
He's a little physical.
Like maybe somebody who could have played in those mid-90s New York teams.
Yeah, if he were a foot taller and a little faster. Yeah.
Like an Anthony Mason type game.
Yeah, exactly.
That's it? Who else was good?
You know, Gary will hit your three for you. You know, he'll spot up and hit a three.
I'm surprised to hear that.
I do believe it's the high school three line, but it's still a three in our game.
Is this does he have a full-length basketball court, or is it like
no,
a half court?
No, it's a half court. And okay. I much prefer to run full length even now. Half court to me is not the same game. It's been a while since I played in there,
Wait a second, though. You just insinuated that you still play.
I do play. I play. I have a standing game in New York every Sunday. That's at Chelsea Pierce.
And you don't play in L.A. though.
No, I don't have a game in L.A. I never got into having a full court game in L.A. And I'm not sure why.
It's tough. You know why? Because it's much tougher to find places to play at night here. It's not like back east. And back east, there's always like, a buddy of mine has a guy at church. We paid off the janitor $40.
Exactly.
We got there. Here, it's like there's a lot of legal stuff, and you can never like sneak into the school. And I don't know why that is, but it kind of sucks.
And not everybody wants to drive 45 minutes to play and then drive 45 minutes back.
Right. Does it bother you that at this point in your career, people don't realize that you're an enormous basketball fan? Like anybody listening to this podcast for the first time had no idea that you were a gigantic basketball fan.
Fan? No, I don't care that they know I'm a fan. It bothers me that they don't know I can play. And I can't prove that on the podcast either, so it's still going to remain that way.
So whose game do you have?
Whose game? Who's my game like?
Yeah.
well, you know, I got that bone to pick with you. You say I look like John Stockton. I don't have his game, and I do not. I do not look like John Stockton, I don't believe.
It was probably a reach. I don't think I'd add a pop culture reference in like two pages, so I needed to work one in.
But I do like your pop culture references, and I did enjoy it. I don't know. I guess, you know, I grew up emulating Walt Frazier and Jerry West, you know, going way back. So I was, you know, what everybody needs, which is a 6-foot shooting guard.
Oh, that's beautiful. You think you could play in the Knicks right now? You could play with Tony Douglas.
Yeah, I was like Charlie Ward without the handle.
Beautiful. I mean, you're a longtime Knicks fan.
Yeah.
Do you have your guard up with this LeBron thing? How are you feeling?
Yeah, I don't know if it's going to happen. I really don't know. I would love to get LeBron, but I'm also old school in that I like teams to actually develop into teams rather than just buying the best player that you can get and hoping that you win a championship that way. You know, I love the Yankees, but it's hard to root for teams that just buy great players. And I know that's the way it is, and I know other people do it, but I would love to see, you know, give us another, well, it would probably take 30 years, but we'd get a team, a nucleus together.
Yeah.
And we could win in 30, 35 years.
I identify with that a little bit because even though it was awesome, obviously, when the Celtics won in 2008.
That wasn't the Celtics. Wasn't really the Celtics.
But
you
I'm saying,
that.
Well, that's my point, is that the only guy I really felt attached to was Pierce because I had watched him for 10 years and I was legitimately happy for him. The other guys I had just met 8 months before, you know, it was hard for me to be like, oh, God, I'm so happy for KG. You know, this guy had no relationship. You know, James Posey, 75% of the team were new guys. And it felt weird last year in the playoffs when they eventually got knocked out in the second round, but were really fighting to show a lot of pride. We were banged
more
up. I felt more attached to that team. I knew those guys at that point. And I think
You were happy for GP, weren't you?
Who's not happy for GP? I do feel like that is one thing that the Knicks fans, you know, I think next year is going to be weird to some degree, that it's going to be like rooting for a fantasy team or a team like a video game team where you get to create your own team with the players, stuff like that. On the other hand, the chance to watch LeBron for 41 games a year plus playoffs, you can't put a price on that.
Well, what are the odds you think of LeBron going to New York?
I think it depends on
if they win this year.
Plays a part of it, because nobody's ever left a team that won the championship to play somebody somewhere else in the history of the league. That's even Wilt won in '67. They lost next year, and then he left. But I think it's really going to come down to how not only the Knicks but everybody in New York passes along the sentiment that this is a different city than all the other cities. And he might know that already because he's played there a couple of times and there's been so much energy in the building. But I don't know if he properly realizes what it would mean to turn basketball around in New York and how much he would mean
true.
To people if he did that.
That's true.
But so how do you convey that to him? I don't know.
I think he probably gets that. I think you're right. I think he probably gets it.
Because he comes, I think, once, twice a year, depending on whether it's usually three games. I think this year, I think he played there twice. But and the Knicks fans always rise to the occasion for him because it's almost like you're like a – it's almost like he's married to somebody else and you're the girl trying to steal the husband away. And you got to, like, dress really sexy and hit on him, basically. And that's what the New York fans do. They want to show him, hey, look, you could have this. We could be yours every game.
You know, I didn't see Cleveland, but if I go in next year and he hasn't made his move yet, I will wear a dress.
It would probably be a good move. We went to the same Knicks game. We were sitting together, but I didn't even know you were there. They showed you on the Jumbotron, and I emailed you after, and you said that it's absolutely the most terrifying thing ever to be shown on the Jumbotron. Why is that?
Well, I just always assume people are going to boo me. You know, it's just like that insecurity that you have. It's like, you're not worthy to be up on the Jumbotron. Sit your ass down. What are you smiling at the camera for?
But you've never been booed, though. You've never been booed, though.
I have not been booed on the Jumbotron, but it's still, it's going to haunt me. I had to, the worst thing happened was I took my kids to a Globetrotters game, and the Globetrotter came up to me and made me dance at midcourt with them. That was almost worse than being on the Jumbotron.
There probably wasn't 15,000 people there, though.
No, but there was like 5,000, you know.
Wow. So you split back and forth between New York and L.A.?
Yeah, mostly New York now, but shoot Californication here in L.A., so that's 3-4 months.
And the difference between the sports scenes, I mean, most people know, but what do you think the L.A. sports scene is missing the most compared to New York?
Well, I guess they always say that the fans are not as rabid, you know, or they leave in the seventh inning from Dodger Stadium, or they just expect the Lakers to win all the time. And I guess there's some truth to that. But you know what? I don't know if there is any longer such a huge difference in all the cities. I know you think Boston, and you may be right. Maybe Boston is the way New York used to be. But to me, I look around and there's all this other stuff that's going on at the games, and I don't know how much people really know about basketball anymore or baseball or whatever, you know? So I don't know. I don't know if there's a difference anymore.
Yeah, I think the difference
don't
is narrowed.
Don't go after LeBron.
Well, I think the difference is narrowed because it's harder to get tickets now unless you have money or connections.
That's
and I
true.
Think the middle lower class fan has been priced out to some degree. So, you know, even last night watching the Red Sox game, Red Sox Yankees, they brought out Neil Diamond in the eighth inning, and at Fenway for the last like 10 years or so, maybe I want to say it started in the late 90s. I can't remember exactly when, but they started playing Sweet Caroline.
Yes, I noticed that when I went to Fenway last summer.
And it was the kind of thing that I'm not sure would have taken off in 1990. Maybe it would have. You know, it's kind of representative of the new regime of what's happened to Fenway and them updating it, and the fact that, you know, they always call the pink hat Red Sox fans. Like, you never saw pink hats at Fenway before 2004,
right.
Stuff like that.
Right.
And it just, I was wondering, like, what would have happened in 1992 if Neil Diamond had come out to sing Sweet Caroline during a Red Sox Yankees game? I feel like they would have thrown things at him. And this time around, they're going crazy and singing along and doing the bump, bump, bah with them. And I don't know. I didn't know if it was a good thing or a bad thing, but I do know if I had been there, I might have enjoyed it. I don't know. It was just weird.
Why Sweet Caroline?
It's just something that started near the end of the games. They play it at the same point every game. And
right.
It really took off like in the last 6 years, last five or six years.
It's a sing-along, isn't it?
So and the crowd would do the bump, bump, bump part. But
I just don't know why the crowd is entertained in this way. You know, look, I sound like the old fuddy-duddy, but like I go to the game because the game is entertaining. You know, I don't need the thunder sticks. I don't need a T-shirt. I don't need any of that. But, you know, I sit there with my kids who are 10 and 7, and that's what they respond to. They love that stuff. You know,
yeah, but
they don't really get the game yet. So they're really happy with Sweet Caroline and the T-shirt machine gun and the stuff that happens in between timeouts.
Yeah, I took my daughter last month, I think, to a Clippers game, which is the worst way to get your kid to like sports, take them to a Clippers home game. It's almost like, it's probably a bad idea. You should do the opposite of that. But, and she looks forward to the cheerleaders and anything that happens in the Jumbotron, the kiss cam, stuff like that.
I will say I do love the kiss cam.
I do enjoy the kiss cam as well. Yeah. I've even written that. I think it should be a TV show. You think, like, NBC, you know, they have this 10 o'clock thing to fill.
Yeah.
I would put the kiss cam on.
Just roll around with the camera? Just roll around with the camera. Whoever is on has to kiss?
I would have to just put 10,000 people in the Staples Center and just go around with the kiss cam and then come back from commercials and just do more. I don't think people would turn the channel for, like, 10 minutes.
It's a strangely beautiful idea.
Thank you. Hey, speaking of TV, you know, X-Files was, I guess, the 90s version of people being into a show so much that it was actually annoying, like how much they analyzed it and peeled apart the layers and argued about it and got together to watch it. I think Twin Peaks actually was the one before that, and then X-Files, and now Lost. Are you following what's happening with Lost at all? I mean,
I have no idea what's happening with Lost.
Right.
I've never seen one. I'm sorry,
but the whole thing about like the internet and people. And your show, I guess the internet was around the last couple of years, but well, not in the form it is now.
No, it kind of, they kind of grew up together in a weird way, because I remember, you know, probably 95, 96, 97, now that's like the third, fourth, fifth years of our show, started to get this idea that there was something out there, that there were chat rooms. I remember hearing that word, you know, chat rooms, and people were talking about the show. So I think that we kind of grew up inside this, like, baby internet, but we never really got exposed to the terrible, the tabloid celebrity internet culture that exists now, or even like what you're referring to with Lost. I'm not sure. So certainly it was maybe a little more innocent back then, but it was coming. It was starting.
I think the big difference, just in terms of the actual TV show, is that people picking apart where plots are going obsessively, like even before the plots are fully developing. And we've even seen in the case of Lost a couple of times where I feel like they jumped out of plots, or they got rid of characters solely because of the reaction on the internet to them.
Well, I think that I remember at some point when a couple of characters in the X-Files were named after certain high-profile fans that the producers were in touch with or were aware of their conversation at some point, and that they were listening to how people were reacting to certain characters and plot lines, and I thought, oh my God, that's horrible.
Ugh. What made you decide eventually to walk away from that show?
Oh, well, it was 8 years, and I just really thought that we'd done, in terms of the television show, we'd done everything we ever set out to do, and it couldn't get bigger, and it could only get worse, and we were getting tired, and I did want to continue that show as a movie franchise, and I thought if we try to go out, we can't go out on top. It was too late for that. But if we go out, you know, not at the bottom, then we can still, you know, go on and make this a movie franchise, which has been tough because, you know, we had the first movie, which did very well, but the second movie that came out a year and a half ago, it was a smaller budget film and had to compete with all the summer blockbusters, and it didn't do as well. So I don't know if there's going to be another one. I hope so, because we all like doing the movies, but just not living our lives solely for that show.
Do you still have people coming up to you talking about aliens and all that weird stuff?
Oh, talking about aliens?
Alternate universes, all that crap, nothing?
Not so much alien. I mean, I don't usually hang out that long. If they lead with the alien thing, I don't really hang out for the rest of the conversation.
It's a good way to get you to keep walking.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, generally no, I think, you know, it's kind of eternally fascinating to people. It comes and it goes. Like, some, obviously when we were doing the show, it was a big deal to speculate about aliens and government conspiracy. And then I think it kind of went out of vogue. And now with the vampire stuff and the Twilight, this kind of supernatural stuff seems to have come back into vogue. So I think it's always going to be in and out that way.
I think that would be the greatest season finale for Californication that you could have. Have it somehow be some sort of alien government conspiracy. Like, just work that in the last one out of nowhere. Everybody freaked out.
I'll have Julian Anderson come in and we'll finish it off.
What happens with Californication going down the road? Because the end of season three was about as dark and dismal as it's going to get for Hank Moody. Yeah. So where does it go?
We like doing that. I think that, you know, we remember and we know that we're a comedy, so we're not gonna stay in that place, even though I like the fact that we're a comedy that can handle that kind of darkness.
How much did you have to do with creating the character?
Very little. It came to me fully written, fully created that way, and, you know, just whatever I brought to it was my interpretation. But in terms of, like, who the guy is, what he does, what he says, that was all Tom Kapanos, the creator of the show.
And what made you decide, I want to play this guy?
It was really, as I said before, it was the kind of the verbal intelligence of a comedic kind of anti-hero. You know, that he was terribly flawed and yet really smart. And how do you make this guy relatable? How do you portray this guy in a way that people are actually going to want to pull for him? And I thought that's a tough one. So let's try it.
Well, I told you, I'm a little embarrassed to admit this because people are going to think my mother is crazy.
Yeah.
Actually, she is crazy. I want you to think that. But
cool.
One of her favorite shows is Californication. She's 62 years old. And I told you this, and I was like, this is a little embarrassing, but my mom loves your show because it's, you know, your show's not exactly a PG show. Some stuff happens on it. There's some nudity.
Right.
There's some sex. There's bad language.
Yeah. Bad language.
And you told me that not only were you not surprised to hear that, but your show does fantastic in that age range.
It's odd. I mean, I don't know that for a fact, but I know just walking down the street in New York, I get more women who appear to be in their 60s coming up to me and saying I love your show than you would imagine.
And you had a theory on this. Do you want to share the theory?
Oh, what was the theory?
My theory
changed all the time. It was that people like get to a certain age and they, you know, they don't care. They're like, yeah, young people, just go have a good time, you know, screw around, have fun, drink, come on, relax.
No. The other theory was better.
What was it?
It was about how Hank Moody is the kind of guy that these women grew up knowing in the 60s, 70s, where everything became politically correct.
Yes. Well, this woman actually said that to me. This woman in her 60s actually came up to me and said something like, oh, God, thank God for your character on TV. Everybody, all these men are such now. You know? I was like, okay, I'm going to keep walking because this is kind of like talking about aliens. So I'm going to go.
Well, I'm even more ashamed to admit this. I threw that theory at my mom. And she was like, oh, yes. Oh, that's why I like it. It reminds me of the old days. I'm like, oh, my God, just shoot me in the head. Can't you watch The Ghost Whisperer? Well, go ahead.
She said, before I met your father, let me tell you some stories.
Yeah, I'm worried about those stories. I just wanted to watch, like, Ghost Whisperer and NCIS LA. I'd be happy with. I'd be happy if she did not watch Californication, but I apparently have no choice.
That's my mommy. That's my mommy watching Dancing with the Stars.
Yeah. I mean, she's looking for a show now, and I was like, what about Parenthood? So she watched some Parenthood, and she was like, not enough oomph to it. And I didn't even want to know what oomph was.
Yeah, you know what oomph is.
Yeah. I don't know if I want to know what the oomph is. But yeah, it was a little too sterile for her, which worried me. Yeah, she was telling me about some show. She saw some movie where Ashton Kutcher's a gigolo. I can't believe I'm telling my stories about my mom. Yeah, she's like, oh, my God, Ashton Kutcher, he's a gigolo, and it's really, really pushes the envelope. And I just can't imagine anything worse than my mom watching a movie where Ashton Kutcher plays a gigolo who's pushing the envelope, whatever that means.
Yeah, you don't want to know what the envelope is.
Yeah, I don't know what the envelope. I don't want to know what the envelope is.
No.
Oh, by the way, you worked with his wife.
To me, yeah.
Was he on the set?
Once or twice. Nice guy. Very, very sharp guy. Sharp. Smart.
Yeah, that's a couple that I thought would have not been around anymore, but it seems...
And yet, you know, yet there they are.
Yeah, the age range, just it doesn't usually have that long of a shuffle for Hollywood.
She's got to be... Was she on your team? She's on your team, right?
Of course.
Yeah.
Oh, there's no question. Yeah. Hold on, I have to have one question from Dan Silver. Who works for ESPN,
really?
Who did 30 for... You saw 30 for 30. He's one of the guys who did 30 for 30 with us. And a self-described gigantic X-Files geek. But his question for you was, how do you develop such natural on-screen chemistry with your female co-stars?
I like the way you read it.
Yeah.
You know, it's just if you don't have it, you just have to kind of... fake it, you know. I mean, it's just that's part of the job. I never understand when people say, "Oh, they didn't have good chemistry." I mean, I always feel like, well, then you didn't do your job. I mean, you're supposed to look like you like man or woman, whatever it is. Like if you're in a buddy picture, you know, you got to make that chemistry. That's part of it. So, I would have to say that's part of the job.
All right. You don't have to name names, but has there been a time where there was just no way you would have liked somebody in real life, but you had to fake the chemistry and you hit it?
Absolutely, absolutely. But you know, there's that old story from I think it's Officer or Gentleman, where, and I don't know who hated who. It was Richard Gere or Deborah Winger, and you know, the fact is that the camera just reads intensity. So hate looks just like love to the camera.
One more question from Dan.
Yeah.
He says, you've created one of the most legendary Geek World characters of all time, meaning that people geek out for it.
Right.
What do you think of the character of Mulder now?
Provocative. Yeah, way to go, Dan. I'll always love Mulder. I got a kick out of him. He was, you know, for being as straight laced as he was irreverent, and I did try to bring some humor into the guy, and I really liked the fact that he was tilting at windmills, you know, that he was fighting that uphill battle and always trying to win a fight that he couldn't win. You know, I respect that in people, and it's fun to play in characters.
My question is, Red Shoes Diaries narrator, badge of honor? Because for me, it would be. That was a very influential show for a lot of teenage kids in the 80s, like myself.
Sure. Well, it was on Showtime, so I gotta say yes, badge of honor. You know, it was... It was an odd gig because I would do that at the same time I was doing the first couple of years of the X-Files. I would fly down to L.A. and do 5 or 6 episodes of Red Shoes in a weekend, you know, because I only had to do these bookends, and I didn't even have to memorize anything. They'd just have the letter. So I would just be like a goofball that would sit on a bench with a dog and read a letter out loud to the camera. And I thought, well, this is easy money, I guess I thought at
That's
that time,
gig.
You know.
All right, my other question is, why haven't you made a sports movie yet?
Well, I sent you Bucky. You know, you got to read it, and then we'll make it. And
would you be in that, though?
No, I wouldn't. I don't think so.
You don't want to play like the coach of a Division I, rundown Division I college basketball team. You're coming back from a drinking problem. They're giving you one last chance. Kind of like Fast Break for 2010.
Yeah, well, you know, I would love it. I actually auditioned for White Men Can't Jump back in the day.
What?
I don't know. That was like one of my first auditions when I came out to LA. I didn't get anywhere on it. I didn't get close. But before you got to read, you actually had to play ball. So that he weeded people that said they could play ball out first.
Uh-oh.
And then you got to read. So I got to read. You know, my ball was good enough. My acting wasn't.
You know what the irony of that is? Well, first of all, Woody Harrelson is an excellent basketball player in that movie.
He's a good ball player.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know now because there's been a lot of marijuana. He might not have the first step anymore. But what's weird to me is...
He's got an unorthodox game, but Wesley Snipes not a ball player.
Yeah, that's the part that I don't get, is they were so careful about the Woody Harrelson casting, as you just said, and yet Wesley Snipes had one of the most annoying sports movie basketball games, I think, ever. Top five.
Well, what I love is whenever they would do slow motion, because obviously they had to, he'd be dribbling, and you would see that the ball was just about to rise over his head after this particular dribble, and then they would cut right at that point, you know? He had no handle, no handle.
How did you feel about the alley-oop at the very end? I don't know if I believe that, if you're dunking home that alley-oop in the Woody Harrelson role.
I've never asked Woody about that. I should ask him.
Because how tall is he? He's not taller than 6 feet.
No, he's just about 6 feet. I don't believe it.
I mean, they, fortunately for him, everybody, you know, that dunk has now been forgotten because Ed Norton's reverse two-hand slam in American History X has now overshadowed all the most unrealistic actor dunks ever. That stands alone. But yeah, that man, that would have been interesting with you. Your whole career would have been different because that was pre-X-Files, right?
Yes, I probably wouldn't have been on the X-Files. You know, there are many movies I did not get that would have made my career different. So,
give me like two more.
Two more?
Yeah. I mean, that's a good one. That's because you do that one.
Well, I guess I read. I forget who fell out of the Brad Pitt role in Thelma and Louise. I believe Billy Baldwin was doing it and fell out, and they were reading for actors to do that, and obviously Brad did it and became a huge star just off that movie. So
yeah.
I guess if I would have gotten that and I would have acted and looked as good as Brad Pitt, which is not likely, then that would have changed things. And then,
but then you did act with him in California with a K.
Yeah, I guess it was probably, was it before or after that?
It was right around the same time.
It was after that, yeah.
Yeah.
And then, I can't remember another one, but I'm sure they're there. Oh, I can tell you that I tested when I first started acting. I tested for the network for Full House, the comedy.
As one as Uncle Jesse or one of the other guys?
I think they had me as everybody. They didn't know where to fit me in. They kept on trying to fit me in somewhere, and they didn't. But I imagine that would have made my career different as well.
And probably not. You probably would have been wealthy, but I'm not sure where you go after that.
Then people would have said they would have known I wasn't funny.
And you're pigeonholed as one of the Full House thing. The White Men Can't Jump thing would have been really interesting, though, because you do that, and then you're probably doing a couple comedies, and
right.
then you probably have to do some crazy erotic thriller as a detective to kind of counteract, oh, I don't want to be pigenholed as comedy guy.
I'm just trying to play it out for you. It's true, but the thing is, to be absolutely honest with you, I was not good enough or ready to do that movie at that point, and there was a reason why I didn't get that role, and somebody like Woody Harrelson would have. And I actually needed the day-to-day acting of what I got to do on X-Files day after day, 10 months, 14 hours a day, and it took me probably 2 or 3 years of doing that to even get to a point where I thought, where I think now that I was halfway decent. So I needed a lot of work to get to where I could access what it is I think I can do. And at that point, that White Man Can't Jump, I couldn't do it.
Sounds like the Malcolm Gladwell Outliers book, where you need 10,000 hours of reps.
You know what? Yeah. I think I needed 10,000 hours of X-Files.
Yeah. And I think you did it. I think there's 10,000 hours of DVDs.
I think there are.
You have 30 seconds now to convince LeBron to become a Knick next year.
LeBron, if you come to the Garden, you will bring a championship to, it'll be like leading the Jews to the Promised Land. It'll be that momentous for New York as a city. You will bring us pride. You will justify our worshiping of our 69, 70, and 72 teams. You'll make us forget about Earl Monroe and Walt Frazier. You will be the only thing that we ever remember will be LeBron.
There it is. David Duchovny. The Joneses coming out April 14th. Movie theaters everywhere. Thanks for being on the BS Report. Come on during the playoffs.
It's my pleasure.
All right. Talk to you soon.
All right. Bye.
Target the Santa.
Whoa.
Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at PodCenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.
With all the talk about sports, Bill Simmons neglected to mention this important just-breaking news. Subway now has breakfast. And unlike the competition, you can get it made just the way you want. Like the Subway Western Egg White Muffin Melt. Add jalapenos, banana peppers, tomatoes, or try Monterey Cheddar. Build your better breakfast at Subway. And after you build your better breakfast, grab your favorite $5 footlong to go. Made to your order all day, every day. Only at Subway.